Welcome to Comment with me, George Galloway, here on Press TV, still the voice of the voiceless. Comment is the big conversation. It can even be the great debate, like my conversation last week with that fellow from Australia who waited up all night to tell us how we should go to war with Iran. I called him a rat in sheep's clothing. It's traveled the world via social media. So it can be a really great debate, but it can only be either a dialogue or a debate if you join in. That's why I need above all your telephone calls. 44208-601-4555. That's the number to call. You call us, we'll call you back. Establish a clear line, and remember, if you get on the television with me, the volume on your television has to be at zero, or no one will understand either of us. You can SMS the show on 44780000806, and it will come up here, if it's good enough, on the comment wall. Ditto with your emails, which can be sent to comment@presstv.co.uk. You can even tweet us at @comment_presstv, and the best of those will come up here on the comment wall. So get dialing and get texting, emailing and tweeting. The question tonight is, what does that Republican letter, this Republican letter to Iran, say about US foreign policy? Well, it says a number of things. The first thing that it says is that at least half of the United States Senate, or virtually half of the United States Senate, think that the Iranian leadership are idiots who don't know anything about American politics, which I'm here to tell you certainly ain't true. For example, the first paragraph reads, "It has come to our attention while observing your nuclear negotiations with our government that you may not fully understand our constitutional question, our constitutional system. Thus, we are writing to bring to your attention two features of our Constitution: the power to make binding international agreements and the different character of federal offices," just in case the Iranians were too stupid to read the United States Constitution, that the Iranian diplomats who have served there and viewed everything that's happening in the United States have absolutely no means of conveying that information to their government, that the New York Post of the Republic of Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran at the United Nations, has somehow missed the nuance of American constitutional politics. So that's the first thing that it says about US foreign policy, that almost half of the senior house of the American Congress thinks that the leadership of the Islamic Republic of Iran are idiots. But the second thing is, for the American people, far more serious. This is essentially an attempted constitutional coup d'etat by almost half of the American Senate. And it is clearly orchestrated by the Israel lobby in the United States, which organized the visit of Netanyahu to that rapturous welcome from both houses of Congress, with only some 50 members of the entire Congress and Senate absent from the speech. It's clearly another reverberation of the Netanyahu visit. Why is it an attempted constitutional coup d'etat? Well, the American Constitution is very clear. It is the President of the United States who controls foreign policy. It is the elected President of the United States who negotiates treaties. And for any citizen of the United States, never mind a senator of the United States, to try to undermine and undercut the elected President of the country is not only unconstitutional, but constitutes treason. That's essentially what the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, said today. It's what a number of concerned citizens of the United States are going to say in a legal action to that effect. It's what hundreds of thousands of American citizens so far in the last 2 days have said in a petition, that this Republican letter is a direct, flagrant, brazen breach of the Nolan Act. The Nolan Act forbids any American, from undermining the President of the United States and corresponding with a foreign power on behalf of the United States. The letter effectively is saying to the Iranian leadership, whatever you decide in negotiation with the President of the United States doesn't matter a damn, because our president will be gone soon. And with the stroke of a pen, the next president will simply countermand him. And in any case, they are saying in this letter, anything that President Obama negotiates with you will be undermined by us. In other words, it's a kind of declaration of war. It's certainly a declaration that President Barack Obama is a dead duck. Now, the hatred of Obama in the United States has always been there. It is now distinctly more palpable. It's partly because he's black. Trust me on that. It's partly because he's a Democrat. It's partly because he doesn't like Netanyahu, and Netanyahu doesn't like him. It's partly because he plainly prefers peace with Iran rather than war with Iran. It's for many, many reasons. But we are today as close as we have been probably for 50 years or more to outright rebellion within the United States governing circles against their own president. These are two of the things that this letter means. We'll ask callers like Farida in London what she thinks of that and about what else this Republican letter might mean. Farida, welcome to the show.
Thank you, George. Good evening.
Good evening to you.
George, I'm going to say something very controversial.
That's not like you, Farida. Go ahead.
Listening to the commentary on this so-called letter, I swear to you, George, I'm coming to the conclusion that the American political system is full of schizophrenic people. What on earth are we, the rest of the world, supposed to make of this kind of behavior? The Americans somehow think that none of the rules, international law, their own constitution, their own conduct is something that they do not have to be accountable for. Who has given the United States of America to behave in this brazen way and then expect people from the rest of the world to say, oh yes, but you see, they are the demigods of this world.
Exceptionalism, that's what they call it, Farida. American exceptionalism. We have to accept that they are exceptional. That's the ideological, intellectual, philosophical theory that lies behind it. Oh, Farida, I hope I didn't cut you off.
No. I'm trying to get my head around this, George.
Yes, it's very difficult, I know.
I cannot understand how the rules and regulations that the Americans insist the rest of the world follows under the banner of democracy is not applicable to them anymore.
Even internally. I mean, you're onto something here. Not only do they claim exceptionality in terms of their behavior in the world vis-a-vis other countries, but clearly, even their own democratic constitution is dispensable, disposable, if the president happens to be a black Democrat who's trying to avoid war. That's the point I'm making. It's a kind of constitutional coup that the Republican Party, driven by Netanyahu, has now mounted.
George?
Yes.
If this is an exercise to gain score partisan political points, I'm afraid it might blow up in their faces. You cannot use your domestic policy and then go on the world stage and behave like absolute despots, because it is not going to take muster with us anymore. It is not acceptable. And I think if the rest of the world does not wake up to what the Americans are up to, we are in for a big shock. And I am absolutely petrified that they will willy-nilly take us into areas where we have no desire to go.
Well, that's right. The world has to wake up, and perhaps us here in Britain more than anyone else. But the Americans have to waken up. The Americans have to ask themselves why the greatest power in the world is being led by the nose by a country of 7 million people thousands of miles away in the Levant on the Mediterranean coast. What is it about this tiny little settler state that the at least one half of the US Senate, and certainly more than half of the US Congress as a whole, well more than half, and most of the political machinery of the greatest power on the earth is being subjugated to, and their interests put second best to, the interests not just of a tiny state of 7 million people, but one led by a prime minister, Netanyahu, who is here today, but may very well be gone in a couple of weeks' time, Farida.
Yeah, but George, unfortunately, Israel has become the last bastion of the American stronghold in Europe. I think even the European governments are not happy about the state that the Americans are getting us into. And unfortunately, Israel is the only country that the Americans feel they have any stronghold
yeah.
in.
Well, it's most peculiar, I'll grant you. Thank you, Farida, for that wonderful opening call. Let's go up to Leicester, talk to Rafiq. Rafiq, welcome to the show.
Yes, sure. How are you doing?
By the grace of God, I'm good. Thanks. Go ahead.
I'm laughing my head off. I mean, this letter, this Congress, or I was sent it to Iran, I think that's stupid. I mean, that's not their country. They can't bully all around the world. Everywhere, because of America, there's war. I was in Africa, I was talking to an American, he says, we know that we are the most hated people in the world. And that's a creation of the American government. Iran has never bombed Hiroshima or anything like that. America has done it. So why is everybody after Iran? I mean, If you look at Israel, it's got nuclear bombs. And they don't want to talk about that. They bombed Gaza. They don't want to talk about rebuilding. They don't want to do nothing. I mean, if you look at the people who are the culprits, that's Israel, the Prime Minister of Israel. But don't forget, Israel is also supported by America. So I don't class Israel being a country of Israel on its independence. It's Americans. So I think we're pushing it too much in this world, something's going to go wrong. That's what makes me scared with the policy they're playing out. If you look in Somalia, you look at in Nigeria, I never seen Boko Haram before. It just happened to be there. Then we see ICL. Who created America? Now ICL going inside, bombing people and killing people. Well, what was America doing about it? And somebody's still supplying the weapons. So it's just a game of invading the countries and taking over the rich part of it, divide and rule. That's what they want to do, I think.
Well, it's a very powerful case that you make, Rafiq, I must say. There on the screen, we just saw a tweet by an American senator accusing President Obama of being part of the family of ISIS. It is symptomatic of the apparent breakdown in President Obama's authority in the United States that a senator could post something like that on Facebook. Rafiq, thanks for that call. We are talking about the US Constitution. The president has the power to negotiate treaties. The president is in charge of foreign affairs. The Congress has no role in either, except a role of reviewing the decisions made by the president. Here we have a situation that the president has not yet concluded a treaty, has not finished his negotiations. There is nothing for the Congress to review, but half of the Senate has fired the torpedo all the way up the Persian Gulf towards the Islamic Republic of Iran, actually spitting contempt for its own president on the way, and clearly, as George Bush would put it, misunderestimating the intelligence of the Iranian leadership. Nobody would misunderestimate Robert in Peterhead. Robert, welcome back to the show. Go ahead.
Good evening, George.
Good evening to you.
Now, I believe that this letter that was put forward by the Republicans not only slanders the nation of Iran and its people, it also indirectly threatens Iran when it claims that any future Republican president could basically throw any deal into the bin, and that even if a deal was reached, it would basically be practically non-existent without Congress, which is now mainly Republican-dominated, voting it through. Now, I believe that this letter says more about the Republican Party and their AIPAC backers themselves rather than foreign policy. It shows that the Republican Party and AIPAC are the ignorant, loud-mouthed bully of American politics that wants to bury its head in the sand while it will wildly lashing out at anything and anyone around it. But then again, that's something we've always known.
Well, but yes, but it is reaching new heights or perhaps depths, Robert. Yeah. There is Rand Paul, who may or may not be the Republican nominee, probably not. If he were, his foreign policy would be different to almost any other potential presidential candidate by the Republicans.
Yeah.
But the Republican Party is now a wholly owned subsidiary of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Yeah,
the problem is, so is well over half of the Democratic Party.
Exactly, yeah.
So you might have a competition when President Obama's term finishes between the ultra-Zionist Republican candidate and the ultra-Zionist Hillary Clinton, the most likely Democratic candidate. Which begs the question, is there any point in the Iranian leadership negotiating with these people at all? No? Robert, thanks for the call. Hans is in Tehran. He'll have a view on that. Hans, welcome. Hello, Hans.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Of course. I mean, I follow the news, and it's difficult sometimes to make up your mind because there's a lot of disinformation, etc. But in this particular case, my opinion, I believe, when these senators fired a torpedo against the negotiations, I only have the explanation that this military and industrial complex is behind it. I have no other explanation. Of course, it has to do with the present negotiations, which obviously come to a final end. So this contract or whatever is not worth the paper where it's written on in the end, you know. So it's like a sabotage, yes. I mean,
well, what they're saying to the Iranian leadership is that whatever you agree with President Obama, we're going to tear up, which I've no doubt is a message that has been heard by the Iranian leadership in Tehran. Why should they make any permanent concessions when the status quo ante will be reverted to in just less than 2 years' time?
I mean, of course. I mean, they survived 30 years of sanctions, and I mean, they will survive. They will continue to survive. Difficult, but they cannot bring them down to the knee. I mean, I think in the end they still have in mind a regime change, like in Damascus.
They'll wait a long time for that, I think. Thanks, Hans. Shukri is in London. Let's hear from him. Shukri.
Good evening, George.
Good evening, sir. Go ahead.
George, I believe, you know, America stands on the wrong side of the history. And the consequence of American foreign policy, look at, they support the most tyrants, the most dictators, the fascists in the Ukraine. Look at what's happening in the Middle East, from Iraq, Syria, to Lebanon, to Palestine, to Libya. So there, everywhere you go, you know, there is a problem, American hand directly in it. This is a consequence of American foreign policy. And second of all, when I looked at Iran, you know, Iran done nothing wrong based on international law, based on IAEA law.
Oh, yeah. On the contrary, they've done everything right. They've bent over backwards to accommodate the international system.
Iran did everything according to the IAEA's documents, and Iran is trying to...
Having difficulty with the phone lines tonight. Iran hasn't attacked, invaded any other country in hundreds of years. Not something that could be said about Britain or the United States. Barry's in Norway. Let's squeeze him in before the break. Barry, go ahead. Barry. Oh dear, the gremlins are in the works this evening. I was making the point that Iran has not attacked anybody for centuries. The state that they call Israel has attacked all of its neighbors and repeatedly, has occupied the territory of its neighbors, has annexed the territory of its neighbors. Iran has no nuclear weapons. Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons. Iran is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel refuses even to discuss its possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons, still less sign the internationally obligatory treaty regulating the possession of nuclear weapons. Iran has allowed the IAEA regularly to inspect its premises and has complied with every demand of the IAEA. Israel won't even talk to the IAEA, has no intention whatsoever of allowing anyone else to regulate its nuclear affairs. Which of these two countries is on the receiving end of economic sanctions, of political calumny, of threat of attack, even invasion, even occupation? It isn't Israel, it's Iran. Now, I've got to take a very short break for a short news bulletin. We're discussing this remarkable letter from the US Senate to the leadership in Iran. Don't go away. If God wills it, I'll still be here when you get back, 3 or so minutes from now. Until then. You're watching Comment with me, George Galloway, here on Press TV. Still the voice of the voiceless, the big conversation, the great debate. But only if you join in. So hit the telephones, send your SMS, your emails, or even your tweets. The big question tonight is, what does this Republican letter signed by almost half of the senators of the United States to the Iranian leadership say about American foreign policy? Well, the first thing it says is that they imagine the Iranian leadership is in need of some kind of seminar on the American Constitution. Unlikely, I know. Certainly the president of Iran got his PhD in Glasgow, and I was his member of parliament when he did it. I even got him a council house. I can assure you, the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran knows more about the Constitution of the United States than the vast majority of citizens of the USA do. And I'm sure that goes for all of the Iranian leadership. Barry in Norway is back on the line. Let's hope we get through this time. Barry, welcome.
Hello, George.
Yes, hello, sir. Go ahead.
Good evening, sir. Let me start it this way. The world is listening and watching. Even the deaf and the blind are listening, and they are with you. They support you, George. And let me start it this way. That Nagasaki, Hiroshima is unforgotten to the world. Panama, Nicaragua, Vietnam, Cambodia, and the killings and the murders, the murderings of leaders in Africa, and you name it. Look, America, they are the one talking about freedom, justice, human right. And the same America are the one sentencing their juveniles underage, putting them into prison. It's the same America. These Republicans, I think, you know, maybe they are drunk. I think they are drunk. How can you deny your president? So that means Obama is does he need to be a president? What is the use of Obama being a president in that America? The world should learn. The world should get up and stand on their feet and protest against America. America is the one running even that UN. Iran has never attacked a country in their life. Never. Iran is not threatening any country in this world. Iran is ready for peace. Iran wants to, you know, build a good relationship with its neighbors and the entire world. What is wrong with this America? What is wrong with these Republicans?
Brilliant.
What is the passionate, use of America?
Passionate point of view, Barry. The point is this, though. They have decided, it's clear, to, without precedent, Vice President Biden said this today, this has never happened in the, I think, 220 years or so that this act, the Nolan Act, has been in force in the United States. This has never happened before. The United States Senate has deliberately staged a provocation at least, and a constitutional coup d'etat at worst, against the US's first black president. Can you smell a rat there, Barry?
Absolutely, George. Absolutely. But we are tired and sick of this. The world is tired and sick of these wars.
Alas, we've lost Barry, but it was a great call while it lasted. There's somebody called Blair in the UK on the line. I wonder if it's him. Mr. Blair, welcome. Hello, Mr. Blair. I thought you'd run away. I felt sure that Mr. Blair in the UK would run away once he had to face me. You can run, Mr. Blair, but you can't hide. You can't hide from the Chilcot report, which is coming soon. You can't hide from my film, The Killings of Tony Blair, which is coming soon. You cannot hide from The Hague and the International Court that's coming for you one day. And you definitely, definitely, definitely cannot hide from the last day, from the judgment day, when you will answer for all of your sins, when you will answer for all of those lives that you took, for all of those lies that you told, for all of the cheating and deceiving that you did in every aspect of your life. You will answer for everything that you did, as all of us will do. That was Mr. Blair in the UK. He didn't have the courage to stay on the line. Might not have been that Mr. Blair, but I thought I'd send Mr. Blair a message in any case. This, of course, is the letter that we are discussing. It has been signed by almost half of the senators. There's their names, one after the other, one after the other, one after the other, have signed a letter which effectively countermands, undermines, subverts the intention of the President of the United States. It has never been done before. And Vice President Biden said today that this was effectively an attempted coup. People are demonstrating in the United States about it. 155,000 Americans in just 36 hours signed a petition calling for the prosecution for treason under the Nolan Act of these senators. So I'm asking, what does this letter say about US foreign policy? Well, one of the things I'm afraid it says is that this man here, even more than this man here and there, is running American foreign policy. And what a shameful moment that represents. The greatest, most powerful country on the earth that there has ever been on the earth is being run by him. Gone today, here today, gone tomorrow, 2 weeks from now, he might well be the ex-prime minister of a small country of 7 million people, thousands of miles away. What kind of United States do we have when a senator puts up on Facebook the President of the United States and accuses him of being a member of ISIS? What he means is that he's black. What he means is that he's probably a Muslim, although he isn't. That's a smear that they have tried to spin in the United States, that he has lied about his religion. And of course, they have, since the very day that he won the election, indeed before he won the election, tried to claim that he was not an American at all and not eligible to be the President of the United States because he was born not in Hawaii, as his birth certificate shows, but outside of the country, in Indonesia or somewhere else. So it tells me that the political order, the democratic facade in the United States is beginning to break down. The veneer of democratic due process in the United States has been torn. It was torn before this letter. It was torn when the Republicans invited Netanyahu to speak in front of both houses of the US Congress when the president said no. And the vice president, who chairs the Senate, boycotted the entire affair. It was a humiliation for the United States. Now, our phone system is down, so I'm going to, while we try to get it back up again, raise a couple of other issues that are on my mind. The first of those is the United Kingdom elections. 56 days from now, Britain will go to the polls. I'll be one of the candidates defending my parliamentary constituency in Bradford West. I will be fighting on my record of more than 40 years in politics and almost 30 years in the British Parliament. I'll be running for my 7th term in Parliament. And I have been elected in 4 constituencies in 2 countries in 6 elections. I'm hoping to make it 7 in a row. But more interestingly, even than the fate of me in the general election, is who's going to be the Prime Minister. Here, again, the veneer of democratic gentlemanliness has begun to break down. I was at Prime Minister's Questions the other day when David Cameron called Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, weak and despicable. Now, I've been in Parliament long enough to know that despicable is not parliamentary language. You can say an action was despicable. You can say a policy is despicable. But you cannot, to his face in the chamber, call a person despicable. Because a despicable person is per se a dishonorable person. And of course, no dishonorable person could be a member of the British Parliament. At least that's what the rules say. But not only did Cameron throw caution to the wind and say it, the Speaker of the House of Commons did not force him to withdraw it. So normal conduct, normal relations between the two big parties in British politics have begun to shred. And that's because this is looking like the closest general election for many, many years, maybe decades. It is distinctly possible that the British general election will not produce any winner at all. It is distinctly possible that we would need a second general election quite soon after the first. Except, just at the beginning of this Parliament, we passed an act called the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which means that the Parliament elected on May the 7th, in 56 days' time from now, is a Parliament that must sit for 5 years, unless, of course, the Parliament repeals it. But as only one of the two main parties at any one time will have an interest in having an early general election, it's equally possible that we will not be able to repeal it. And therefore, the House of Commons that is elected on the 7th of May will sit for an entire 5-year term with no majority for anybody sitting within it. And that will be a very, very fluid political situation indeed. I make no apology for saying that I'm hoping that Ed Miliband is the Prime Minister without a majority, and that the majority is me. If the majority is me, Ed Miliband will have to come to me on a daily basis and negotiate with me in order to get his business through later that evening. That would be perfect, wouldn't it? Here are my demands. In exchange for the withdrawal of British forces from all offensive action everywhere in the world, the withdrawal of the British government from NATO, the war alliance dominated, led by the United States of America, in exchange for the abolition of Britain's nuclear weapons fleet, its withdrawal of foreign forces from everywhere in the world, its pursuit of the tax evaders with their secret bank accounts in Switzerland and elsewhere, in exchange for an end to the endless austerity attacks on the poor and the disabled and the unemployed and the low paid and the public service workers, in exchange for all of these things, yes, Mr. Miliband, I'll vote with you this evening. As to tomorrow, you'll have to come back and negotiate with me again, because I have other demands. So the UK general election is something that we'll be covering in the coming weeks increasingly closely. Because, of course, it doesn't just matter for the people who live in the United Kingdom. It matters to the people who live elsewhere in the world. Because if we had a United Kingdom that was not the tail of the American dog, if we had a United Kingdom that had an ethical foreign policy rather than an utterly immoral one, if we were a force for peace rather than a force for war, if we were a force for nuclear disarmament as opposed to a force for nuclear rearmament, well, that would be good, wouldn't it? And, of course, there is the continuing atrocities of ISIL. But ISIL are now on the run. In the city I know well of Tikrit, there are only 150 of these Takfiri fanatics left holed up in the former Saddam Hussein palace and other government buildings. Some of the others have escaped, perhaps many of the others. Many have been killed. It's an important force that is now cleaning the streets of Tikrit. It involves, of course, the Iraqi army. It involves, of course, Shiite militia and also assistance from the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is, of course, Iraq's next-door neighbor. But most importantly of all, it is a force that contains Sunni, Arab, Iraqi tribesmen, many of them from the tribe of Saddam Hussein, many of them from other tribes in the west of Iraq that are finally rising up against ISIL. Thousands of them. There's 1,000 of the force which is now liberating Tikrit from Saddam Hussein's tribe itself. There are thousands more, and they are linking arms. Sunni, Shia, Iran, the Iraqi army, they are linking arms to finally destroy this infestation called ISIL that has caused so much blood, suffering, and misery in Iraq. After Tikrit comes Mosul, the biggest prize of them all. But it is being done without the United States of America and without Britain and without France and without other contributions from other countries. And that's important too, because this is a matter that has to be resolved by Iraq and its immediate neighbors. There is no need for the involvement of the former colonial powers. Indeed, the involvement of the former colonial powers will merely make the problem worse rather than better, will merely make ISIL stronger rather than weaker. So I'm very happy at the military turn of fortune, change of fortune for those now seeking to liberate Tikrit. It is possible to glimpse the beginning of the end of ISIL, at least in Iraq. But of course, that will not be the end of the matter. Political reform and an all-inclusive national government in Iraq remains a vital necessity. What happens on the battlefield will have to be reflected, will have to be mirrored inside the parliament and the government in Baghdad. And I pray that that should be so. Because, you know, we have to shake ourselves free of the idea that the United States of America is either the arbiter of or the architect of a recovery of peace and prosperity and growth and development in the world. The United States is politically and economically enfeebled. The high point of the American empire has passed. Its best days are behind it. If we continue waiting for Godot, waiting for the United States to intervene, interfere in places like Ukraine, in places like Iraq and Syria, then we're waiting for something that can never arrive, at least with enough strength, sagacity, and wisdom to actually change things for the better. If we persist in allowing other people to take the important decisions concerning our lives, our country, our regions, then we deserve all we're going to get. This is why I've tried to argue. Of course, Netanyahu is calling the shots. But if he can call the shots, why shouldn't he? Don't blame him. Blame the United States of America. We've got some lines up now. And Gary, in Nova Scotia, in Halifax, in Canada, is the next up on the line. Gary, welcome.
Boy, do I feel welcome. George, I've got the thing that you can do like nobody else. Someone has to get to the bottom of this question. Does Benjamin Netanyahu possess American citizenship like many of his Israeli fellow citizens do? Because, of course, if he does, it means the speech that he gave that triggered all this other stuff is a violation of the Logan Act. It's the attempt of someone who is a civilian in U.S. terms trying to conduct the foreign policy of the United States.
That's absolutely right, and thanks for correcting me. It is, of course, the Logan Act, which makes illegal any interference by anybody in the United States, never mind the Senate, in foreign policy treaty negotiations, Gary.
Absolutely. You know, there are a number of things. Speaking of the Senate and its powers of approving treaties, there are a number of very important relations the United States has in the world that have never been brought to the Senate for ratification.
Yeah.
Example number one, the relationship with Saudi Arabia, carved out between Roosevelt and Faisal just before the end of World War II.
Well, we'll have to stop on that one, but it's a vital one, and you're absolutely correct. We can continue the discussion on Twitter at @comment_PressTV. Sorry for the technical hitches. Hope I managed to hold your attention.
Hello, just comment your name and the number. And just make sure that your television volume is set to 0.
0, 0. Can you spell your name for me?
Yeah, I know. You can directly put through this. Your phone number and then we'll be back.
Comment. Can I have your telephone?